concern. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. More than 300,000 new COVID cases a day and hospitals and crematoria facing collapse, Director General of the World Health Organization, WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, has called the situation in India beyond heartbreaking. The Indian government has blamed the people for not following COVID-safe public health directives, but recent data shows use of face masks has only fallen by 10 percentage points, from a high of 71% back in August of 2020 to a low of 61% by the end of February this year. And the mobility index increased by about 20 percentage points, although most sectors of the economy and activity had opened up. These are modest changes and do not adequately explain the huge increase in the number of coronavirus infections and cases. A more likely explanation is the impact of the variants that are more transmissible than the original SARS-CoV-2 virus. Viruses keep changing and adapting through mutations, and new variants of a virus are expected and tracked in a pandemic situation such as this. The Indian SARS-CoV-2 Genomics Consortium, or INSACOG, a group of 10 national laboratories, was set up in December of 2020 to monitor genetic variations in the coronavirus. The laboratories are required to sequence 5% of COVID-positive samples from states and 100% of positive samples from international travelers. The United Kingdom is currently testing about 8% of its positive samples and the United States of America about 4% of its samples. India has been testing about 1% altogether. INSACOG, the Indian SARS-CoV-2 Genomics Consortium, has so far tested 15,133 SARS-CoV-2 genomes. This means of every 1,000 cases, the United Kingdom has sequenced 79.5, the United States has sequenced 8.59, and India just 0.0552. In the final week of December 2020, India detected 6 cases of the UK variant, the B117 variant of the coronavirus, among international travellers. The current second wave started in the northwestern state of Punjab in the first half of February and has not yet plateaued. One of the advisers to the Punjab government confirmed that more than 80% of the cases were attributed to the UK variant of the coronavirus. Significantly, the most affected districts are the Punjab's Doaba region, known as the NRI or Non-Resident Indian Belt. An estimated 60% to 70% of the families in these districts have relatives living abroad, mostly in the United Kingdom or Canada, and a high volume of travel to and from these countries. The B1617 variant, or what has been called the Indian double mutation, has drawn attention because it contains two mutations known as E484Q and L452R that has been linked to increased transmissibility and an ability to evade the human immune system. Many experts in India now think this is driving the surge in the number of infections. Even as India's health ministry announced the detection of the mutants on 24th of March, it added, "These have not been detected in numbers sufficient to either establish a direct relationship or explain the rapid increase in cases in some states." The head of the Indian Council of Medical Research said there was no reason to panic because mutations are sporadic and not significant. That day, the state of Maharashtra and Punjab accounted for 62.5% and 4.5% of 40,715 new cases, respectively. Across the world, several key mutant strains have emerged thanks to ongoing virus replication in humans. both ability to replicate and transmit and a better ability to escape our immune systems led to the variants establishing themselves as dominant strains across geographies and populations. The UK variant, the B117 variant, is at least 30% more transmissible. At a recent webinar, Indian experts observed that the Indian strain of the coronavirus, the B1617 strain, is similarly transmissible to the UK variant, but there is little evidence so far of it being more lethal than the original virus. Why higher transmissibility is so concerning? According to epidemiologist Adam Kucharski at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, the conundrum is this. Suppose 10,000 people are infected in a city and each infects 1.1 other person on average, the low end for the estimated rate of infection in England. After a month, 16,000 people would have been infected. If the infection fatality rate is 0.8%, as it was in England at the end of the first wave of the infections, it would mean 128 deaths. He said with a variant that is 50% more deadly, those 16,000 cases would result in 192 deaths. But with a variant that is 50% more transmissible, though no more deadly, there would be 122,000 extra cases after a month, leading to 976 deaths. In all likelihood, this is the current Indian scenario, a higher overall death count despite the variant being no more fatal in relative terms. Setting up a genomic surveillance system and consistently testing 5% of the positive samples is an expensive but important tool in the journey ahead. This can help us identify emerging hotspots, track transmission, and enable nimble-footed decision-making and tailored interventions. Death and infection rates have been rising exponentially throughout April in India, with experts blaming mass gatherings in India. On Thursday, 29th of April, the South Asian nation reported 3,645 deaths over the past 24 hours. While confirming, new cases hit a new global record with more than 379,000 new cases. The official numbers are widely believed to be far below actual infections. The pandemic has claimed at least 3.1 million lives around the world, with India accounting for more than 200,000 fatalities, the worst death toll outside the Americas. The US is the worst affected country, with more than 570,000 deaths, and Brazil reached 400,000 deaths on Thursday, 29th of April, after the country was devastated by a surge in the number of cases at the start of the year that push hospitals to the brink of collapse in many areas of Brazil. Its daily average death toll of 2,526 over the last week remains second only to India. In many Indian cities, hospitals are running out of beds as relatives of the sick jostle for medicines and oxygen cylinders. The Indian government opened vaccinations to all adults from Saturday, 1st of May. However, several states have warned they do not have sufficient vaccine stocks and their expanded rollout is threatened by administrative bickering, confusion over prices, and technical glitches on the government's digital vaccine platform. India's Foreign Secretary Harshvardhan Shringla said more than 40 countries have committed to sending India vital medical aid, particularly oxygen. The supplies include almost 550 oxygen-generating plants, more than 4,000 oxygen concentrators, 10,000 oxygen cylinders, as well as 17 cryogenic tankers. Hundreds of thousands of doses of COVID-19 treatment drugs as well as raw materials to produce vaccines were also being sent to India.
inside Israel.
Anti-Semitism has been widely used to slander all those who do not agree with Israel in whatever the case might be. But now, Israeli officials are being accused of anti-Semitism. New videos have been recently released by Israeli officials that actually mocks other Israelis and Jews in ways that can only be explained as anti-Semitic. The term has gained widespread popularity on an international level, mainly due to wide use, or some now say abuse, of the word by Israeli officials themselves to justify pretty much everything they do, from internal policy to external policy. But for Israeli officials, the term doesn't come any more handy than when others are criticizing them. When Israel is criticized, it automatically uses the anti-Semitic card to slander others. But what happens if the table is turned? We've all heard of Israeli officials and the regime in general call anyone that points to their crimes against humanity, war crimes, and their dysfunctional system as anti-Semitic. But activists from the non-for-profit U.S.-based Electronic Intifada online newspaper have found that the Israeli regime in its nature is actually anti-Semitic. According to the Electronic Intifada, Israel's new ambassador to the U.K. stereotyped a Jewish human rights group in anti-Semitic terms in a video she released as part of a campaign for her political party. In a Hebrew YouTube video, Israeli Ambassador Zipi Hotoveli mocked breaking the silence as being motivated by money. The video depicts Jews as greedy. According to Jews Worldwide, and of course Israel, depictions of Jews as being greedy is a major theme in the history of anti-Semitic stereotypes. Breaking the Silence, by the way, is an Israeli NGO established in 2004 by veterans of the Israel military and aims to shed light on the cruelty of the Israeli occupation in occupied Palestinian territories. The video also targets Israeli human rights groups B'Tselem, calling them extreme left, and accuses them of receiving funding from the European Union and being agents of the EU. The video calls on the extreme right to attack these organizations so that their funding will cease to exist.
Anti-Semitism is basically a system that is designed to suppress all forms of criticism of Israel, Jewish culture, Jewish religion, Jewish politics, or should I say, everything Jewish. Whether there is really hatred toward Jews for being Jews in the world, I actually hardly believe it. I think that a lot of people oppose Israel, and for a good reason, and it should be legitimate. A lot of people oppose some aspect of Jewish culture, aspect of Judaism, definitely aspect of Jewish politics, and all of that should be totally legitimized. As long as we don't hate people for being a people, I think that all criticism should be considered legitimate. I think that it is way more than Israel. The answer is obviously yes, but it's not just Israel. This is something that we see throughout the entire spectrum of Jewish politics, and it's not just Jewish politics. We can see that all over the world, politicians are using weaponizing anti-Semitism in order to serve their own interests. We saw it in Britain in the case of Jeremy Corbyn. We saw it in the American election. Both sides accuse the other of anti-Semitism. And it's pretty, meaningless, because really you cannot find a single voice in the political arena, in the arts, in academia, who criticizes Jews for being Jews. Again, people criticize Jews legitimately for politics, for culture, for Israeli politics. You have to remind you that Israel calls itself the Jewish state and claims to represent world Jews. Whether it is true or not is another question.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. On Twitter, Guy Blue says, well, anti-Israel doesn't necessarily mean anti-Semitic. Anak sarcastically says, people are calling Betaslim anti-Semitic. At this point, anyone who criticizes Israel is anti-Semitic, even Israelis. CEO of Corn says, but it does feel a little strange that it can be considered anti-Semitic to criticize Israel, not Jews, but the Zionist portion of the regime, for genuine humanitarian crimes, or labeling American anti-Semitic fascist Nazis being considered insensitive.
Shameful what Israel has done and the supporters of Israel have done in terms of false accusations of anti-Semitism. I say that it's dangerous because anti-Semitism is something that is very real, and it usually occurs in modern times within the context of a rise in Islamophobia, a rise in anti-Black hatred, a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment. So it's usually part of a larger rise of fascism in these modern times. And Israel has used accusations of anti-Semitism in order to protect themselves from criticism for their system of apartheid and their human rights abuses towards Palestinians. This takes place both from the State of Israel and from supporters of Israel, including pro-Israel lobby groups in the U.S. And what it does is it really confuses people as to what anti-Semitism is and as to the real dangers of anti-Semitism. Could say that the use of anti-Semitism has backfired against Jews around the world and against so many people who experience racism and xenophobia by falsely conflating anti-Semitism, a very real danger, with criticism, legitimate criticism of Israel's human rights abuses. We dilute the impact of calling out and combating anti-Semitism. And so defense of Israel by Israel as a state and by pro-Israel groups and individuals continues to create a real danger for Jews around the world and for our allies who we are working together with to secure safety for all people.
ZP Hotavelli is the same person who back in 2019, during the British elections, accused then-Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn of anti-Semitism, calling him troubling and a real danger to Israel. This shows the double standards of Israel's principles and practice of hard-right Jewish ethno-nationalism are now simply the new normal in Israeli politics, according to the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, Anthony Lerman. For Israel and many of its officials, the only definition of anti-Semitism that matters is failure to support Israel. This isn't the first instance of Israeli officials and anti-Semitism. In 2017, Israeli-American multimillionaire and key Israel lobby donor Adam Milstein depicted liberal Jewish billionaire George Soros as an octopus with tentacles spanning the globe, practically identical to Nazi propaganda. In 2015, a regime-funded body representing Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank released a video which depicted a Jewish-European conspiracy to fabricate war crimes against Israel. Many see Israel's actions as part of a growing trend to equate criticism of Israeli regime policies with anti-Semitism. Scholars from all over the world have noted that it is increasingly difficult to have a proper discussion about Zionism or a normal critical debate about Israel. Earlier this year, in Germany, a renowned scholar, Achille Mbembe, who is currently teaching at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, was accused of racism and anti-Semitism by public figures and institutions because of his support of the BDS movement. BDS, that is Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, is a Palestinian-led global movement for the freedom, justice, and equality of Palestinians. His case is just one of many.
Yes, completely legal and ethical. The State of Israel doesn't let to do these critics, but ethically it's completely good to say you are doing something wrong. You have to change this policy, same as you can say to other states. There, the countries in the world, they can make errors, or they can do things that are very bad against humans, against human rights. And you have to, if you are a journalist or a political scientist or a professor, you have to say the truth. So maybe they change their ways of behavior. Yes, they are criticizing everyone that it's not from a right-wing ideology. And this right-wing is similar to fascism and Nazism. They are saying, for example, to liberal Jews or to socialist Jews that they are anti-Semites. The Nazi regime in Germany of Hitler accused the Jews to be or capitalist exploiters or communist propagandists. So the Israel regime now is trying to do the same thing to Jews that they are liberal. They accuse that they are capitalist and they sell by money and greed and all these things. And if they are socialists, they say that they are communists, like it still used to be the Soviet Union. That is the case of a liberal Jew named George Soros. He's an Hungarian from Hungary, a liberal Jew that is criticized to be an anti-Semite because he's a liberal Jew and the Hungary government is a friend with the Zionist state now, and they both are ultra-right wings, and they are really the bad guys, and they are making guilty liberals or socialists.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. King Benjamin says, if you're against funding for Israel, you're anti-Semitic. Kevin says, but of course, it's easier to cry anti-Semitism and try to slur Bet Eslam through guilt by association than address its substantive criticism, because the report's analysis and conclusions are careful, sober, and convincing. Jesse says, yes, it is totally absurd. Israel is an awful apartheid entity. 100% agree about the irony in it all. I always say it's not anti-Semitic to be anti-Israel.
Well, of course, we get into the complexity of the overlap between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Zionism is a term an ideological term that emerges from the late 1800s. Theodore Herzl began a process where there was a lobbying, an effort to create a Jewish state in the Middle East. That is what Zionism is. And Zionism, of course, there's a range of Zionist interpretations and manifestations of that ideology, going from labor Zionism to revisionist Zionism on the right wing. There are many Jewish people from the beginning of Zionism who were hostile towards Zionism, who thought that it was wrong to associate their religion with a political movement. And there are still many Jews, especially Orthodox Jews and rabbis in Israel, who think it's wrong to use the Jewish religion as a basis for the creation of a Jewish state. So there are secular critics of Zionism as well, Jewish voices for peace in the United States, independent Jewish voices here in Canada. And these are Jewish people who are critical of Zionism and are critical of the treatment by the Israeli government, especially of Palestinian Arabs, and the torture and maltreatment and failure to recognize and indeed the tendency to crush the human rights of Palestinian people. And those Jewish critics very much resent being called anti-Semitic because they're Jewish. But of course, oftentimes the term self-hating Jews comes up, and this group can be condemned as self-hating Jews. So it's complex. Well, it may have been overused, but the power of the Israel lobby is such that there really isn't a lot of debate, say within the United States, say within Canada, say within Great Britain, about how the Israeli state abuses this term, anti-Semitism. It's kind of a dangerous ground to even criticize the Jewish state for abusing the term anti-Semitism. So this is a phenomena that sees, although it might be overused, there isn't a lot of tolerance for any real discussion of these issues. I look to my Canadian Parliament and I don't see the possibility of much discussion because all political parties are of a similar mind when it comes to Israel. They identify and support Israel in large measure. So this abuse of the term anti-Semitism, it comes out particularly in the way that the International Holocaust Remembrance Association definition of anti-Semitism is being adopted by many governments, by many municipalities, by many universities, by many labor unions. All kinds of agencies adopt this definition, which basically says that to criticize Israel is to be anti-Semitic, that any criticism of Israel can be interpreted as anti-Semitic. There should be much more debate on this, but the context seems to not be there. Well, anti-Semitism is a very ironic phrase. You could say that Semites don't include Ashkenazi Jews, for instance. I mean, Jewish people are genetically diverse. They have many backgrounds. They're not at the moment Jewish people. It's not a particularly missionary religion, but it has been in the past a missionary religion, and Ashkenazi Jews derived from people who were converts to Judaism. And so ironically, Ashkenazi Jews tend to have an elite role within Israel, an elite role within the Jewish community collectively, and this group of people who are not Semites use their power against people who are Semites, including the Palestinians and other Arabs. So that's a great irony of the term.
It seems that the burden that Israel has imposed on all those who are criticizing it has backfired. Israel seems to use anti-Semitic as a weapon, but that weapon has backfired as it has been overused and exhausted. And now Israel's adversaries, who are Jewish and Israeli, are becoming victims of Israel's anti-Semitic slander. This same slander of other people who do not agree with Israel has exposed Israel for what many believe is anti-Semitic in nature. Ultra-Orthodox Jews accuse the ruling white European Jewish secular class in Israel as stealing their identity and their name. According to ultra-Orthodox Jews, elite European secular Zionist white Jews at the turn of the 19th century absorbed the attitudes of anti-Semites in Europe and looked at the real Jews themselves with the same disgust and loathing that the anti-Semites did.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
World Quotes Day. Article 152 of Iran's constitution says that foreign policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran is based on negation of any dominance or acceptance of dominance, preservation of Iran's independence and territorial integrity, defense of the rights of all Muslims, and non-alignment against hegemonic powers. Article 154 of the Constitution also makes it clear that supporting the oppressed is a religious and ideological obligation, which has been raised as a principle in Islamic jurisprudence. Therefore, the Islamic Republic of Iran, whilst refusing to interfere in the internal affairs of other countries, supports rightful struggles of the oppressed and downtrodden against oppressors and the global arrogance in every region of the world. No doubt, one of the greatest oppressions throughout history is the violations of the rights of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian nation, and the expulsion of Palestinians from their ancestral homeland. The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, said on the importance of defense of the Islamic lands and unity of Muslims. Imam Khomeini said, "Defending the honor of Muslims and Islamic lands and defense of every dignity of Muslim is a necessary thing, and we should make ourselves prepared for the divine goals and defense of Muslims. Seeking justice, supporting the oppressed people, striving for safeguarding human values, and contributing to achieving common human ideals are among the teachings of Islam. Such an approach shows that defense of the oppressed is indeed awakening of nations, and the Iranian nation is proud of initiating this path. The Iranian nation has resolutely continued this path in spite of myriad obstructions, pressures, and conspiracies for more than four decades." The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, speaking on the occasion of the World Quds Day, the last Friday of the blessed month of Ramadan in 2020, the leader said, "Today, the world is counting each and every victim of coronavirus across the world, but nobody has asked or is asking for the killers and those responsible for hundreds of thousands of martyrs, captives and missing in the countries where the United States and Europe have ignited the fire of war. Who is responsible for this much bloodshed that has been shed unjustly in places like Afghanistan, Yemen, Libya, Iraq and Syria? Who is responsible for this scale of crime, usurpation, devastation and oppression in Palestine? Why has nobody counted these millions of innocent children, women and men in the Islamic world? Why doesn't anybody express condolences over the massacring of innocent Muslims? Why should millions of Palestinians reside outside of their ancestral homeland and reside in exile for over 70 years? And why should the Holy Quds, the first Qibla of Muslims, be disrespected? The so-called United Nations does not fulfill its duties, and the so-called human rights institutions have not done their duties. The slogan of defense of rights of children and women does not include the innocent children and women of Yemen and Palestine. This is the situation of the oppressive Western powers and the dependent global organizations. Moreover, the situation of the governments hanging on them in the region is also too scandalous to be mentioned. Therefore, the valorous and devoted Muslim community should rely on itself and on its internal powers to sleeve up its strong arm and pass over the obstacles with trust in God Almighty." More than 70 years have passed since the sinister inception of the Zionist regime of Israel, formed in the heart of the Islamic lands and the occupation of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israel's origins are deeply embedded in terrorism, occupation and usurpation. The scandalous stillborn deal of the century has been designed to violate the rights of the Palestinian people and erase the issue of Palestine from world public opinion. The child-killing regime in Tel Aviv, with the full support of the great Satan, the United States, and equally criminal regimes in Europe, and the submissive Arab sheikhdoms in the region, have committed innumerable crimes throughout its unholy existence. It is continuing its crimes even in the blessed month of Ramadan, especially in the Gaza Strip. Although this fake and fabricated regime has become more brutal than ever before, the signs of its ultimate collapse and annihilation have become manifestly evident. The Zionists have made every effort to depict themselves as innocent, with the right to commit any crime against the Palestinian nation. With the help of Western media, they have tried to brand every effort in support of Palestine as terrorism. But the Quranic approach of the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, and his rightful successor Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, namely that of resistance, has totally changed the fate of Palestine and the region, and is going to exterminate the illegitimate and cancerous tumor that is Israel. Resistance has thwarted all plots that have been hatched in the region by the Zionist regime and its partners in crime. Resistance and Intifada have preserved the issue of Palestine as the first and the main issue of the Islamic world, and have not allowed the cause of Palestine to be marginalized by compromising schemes.
Around the World with Reporters.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in to mark World Press Freedom Day. World Press Freedom Day is observed annually around the globe on the 3rd of May as a reminder that freedom of the press is a fundamental human right. Israeli forces killed and injured hundreds of Palestinian journalists over the past two decades and haven't been held accountable for their crimes. Currently, 16 Palestinian journalists are being held in Israeli jails, including four under administrative detention. During a press conference, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate demanded an end to Israel's impunity.
Palestinian journalists are subjected to Israeli aggression, including killings and arrests almost every day, whether while they are covering the news or even inside their workplaces. Journalists are constantly threatened by Israeli forces. Such Israeli attacks and threats amount to war crimes, and we have reported these crimes to the International Criminal Court.
Israeli violence against journalists includes physical and verbal assault, as well as degrading treatment. Observers say the Israeli regime forces aim to keep journalists and mass media away from covering their crimes.
The silence of the international organizations has encouraged Israeli forces to further violate the rights of Palestinian journalists. All international press unions and syndicates must stand by Palestinian journalists and exert pressure on Israel to stop its immoral and illegal practices against journalists.
Israeli forces attacked several Palestinian media offices during the last three wars on the Gaza Strip. Since the beginning of 2020, Israeli forces carried out over 200 attacks against Palestinian journalists.
Over the past 4 months, Israeli forces carried out more than 217 violations against Palestinian journalists and media offices throughout the Palestinian territories. The attacks happened despite the protection that journalists enjoy under international law. It's crystal clear that Israeli attacks on Palestinian journalists are deliberate and systematic.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye.
On World Press Freedom Day, journalists demand international protection. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran says substantial progress has been made in several rounds of Vienna talks between Iran and their remaining signatories to the JCPOA. Speaking at an online press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh told reporters the Islamic Republic of Iran wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the nuclear deal.
The negotiators have come up with two drafts so far, but there are still differences that need to be discussed. The Islamic Republic wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the JCPOA. Iran would verify the sanctions removal since those measures have deprived Iran of its JCPOA benefits. The remaining parties engaged in Vienna talks are also concentrating on the way the U.S. could return to the deal.
Regarding the statements by Iran's top negotiator in Vienna, Abbas Araghchi, who suggested that a list of sanctions on individuals and on Iran's energy, auto, financial, insurance and port sectors have been agreed to be lifted, the foreign ministry spokesman said all sanctions under different labels should be lifted.
A red line is that all sanctions reimposed and those imposed under different labels must be lifted. There has been agreement on many issues, but there are also disagreements. Developments are significant and good, but it's slow in some areas.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal has survived almost 3 years of unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018. Iran, in return, reduced its own commitments as a tit-for-tat by adopting a stepwise suspension of its nuclear commitments. Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal have held several rounds of talks in Vienna to discuss how the U.S. should return to the JCPOA.
The Iranian officials say the path is clear. The U.S. must terminate all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to full compliance. Otherwise, Iran will simply quit the talks. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Yemeni army said it had launched an operation using 4 drones of Qassaf K2 type and 2 ballistic missiles of Badr type against Saudi Arabia, targeting King Khalid Air Base in Asir and other military targets in Najran Airport.
Our operation targeted Saudi airports because they are being used for warplanes to take off and launch airstrikes on the Yemeni people. They are also used to reinforce the Saudi-backed forces in Ma'rib and the rest of the battlefronts. We carry out the operation based on accurate information that reached us from the Saudi depths.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army said this attack came in response to the continued escalation of airstrikes by Saudi Arabia and its tighter restrictions on fuel imports. He vowed larger attacks if the war is not yet stopped.
The continuation of the Yemeni attacks deep inside Saudi Arabia confirms that the Yemeni army has developed its military capabilities to inflict further damage to Saudi sites. The Yemeni army aims to protect Yemen's airspace against Saudi airstrikes in conjunction with the continued advancement toward the city of Ma'rib.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a deadly war against Yemen in March 2015. The Saudi war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children, and brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations. Experts say the Yemeni army's retaliatory attacks sent this clear message to Saudi Arabia and its allies that the more attacks against Yemeni civilians and tighter blockade, the more painful attacks against Saudi facilities. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
U.S. President Joe Biden called North Korea a threat in his first address to Congress as his administration announced it had completed a long-awaited review of American policy toward Pyongyang. Biden's remarks were soon followed up by his Director of National Intelligence.
For its part, North Korea may take aggressive and potentially destabilizing actions to reshape its security environment and will seek to drive wedges between the United States and its allies. These efforts could include the resumption of nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missile testing in the future.
North Korea reacted harshly to the comments, with a leading official saying the U.S. would face a very grave situation if it did not end its hostile policy. In South Korea, Washington's rhetoric was met with disappointment.
The Biden administration has said it will pursue resolute deterrence while the North Korean nuclear issue is a threat to the world peace. So for Pyongyang, Washington's hostile policy seems only a pretext to strengthen itself.
North Korea has been subject to U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions, which Pyongyang would like to be suspended. There are also other moves the U.S. could make to get talks going.
Since there is a large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises in August that North Korea sees as a hostile, an announcement suspending these drills would help create an atmosphere of dialogue.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in is set to meet with President Biden at the Oval Office later this month, where he's likely to press for engagement between the U.S. and North Korea. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Sunday that Washington's policies not aimed at hostility, but solutions. The question is whether those solutions involve U.S. incentives that will bring Pyongyang to the negotiating table. Frank Smith, Seoul.
U.S.-led NATO forces are spending their last months in Afghanistan, and this is good news for most American soldiers. They will finally witness the end of their mission in a country historically known as the Graveyard of Empires. This is why the U.S. war in Afghanistan has so far claimed the lives of 90,000 U.S.-led NATO troops and Afghan armed forces. However, military top brass in Kabul insists that there is zero chance of victory for the Taliban through militarism, despite a start of foreign troops withdrawal from Afghanistan on Saturday. This is because the Afghan government is now strong enough to counter terrorist groups on its own and also enjoys high popularity among locals.
بیرون شدن.
The withdrawal of foreign forces has practically started. They will hand over their military bases and some of their military hardware to Afghan forces by the end of this week. We are strong enough and we can safeguard the nation on our own.
In the meantime, the Taliban have not welcomed the troop pullout by Washington, saying the U.S. had agreed to withdraw all foreign military forces from Afghanistan by the May 1st. This has paved the way for the Taliban to legitimize their acts of violence beyond May the 1st. Under such circumstances, civilians will once again turn into the main victims of violence in the war-weary country.
Foreign troops must leave our country, and the Taliban are also expected to respect people's demand, that is the silence of guns. There must be no war among ourselves after the withdrawal of foreign troops, and the Taliban need to realize this reality.
The Taliban are seeking excuses to keep saying no to peace. The postponement of the U.S. military withdrawal has now turned into a good pretext for them to wage more war and kill more defenseless civilians.
The Taliban have vowed to take any possible action because of what they call the violation of the Doha Agreement by Washington, that is the delay in the withdrawal of foreign troops from Afghanistan. However, what remains to be a bitter truth is that not many players seem to be ready to truly help Afghans see a day when there is no war and insecurity in their wounded homeland. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Pakistan's federal parliament in Islamabad. The lower house of the parliament is preparing to resume a debate on whether or not to expel French ambassador over repeated incident of blasphemy in France against Islam's last prophet Muhammad. However, days before the resumption of parliamentary debate here, the European Union Parliament has come up with what appears to be counter-resolution to pressurize Islamabad to prevent the expulsion of French envoy from Pakistan. The European Parliament has decided to review with Pakistan our trade agreement known as Generalized System of Preferential Plus or GPS Plus over what it calls a rising anti-French sentiments and mistreatment of minorities under blasphemy laws in Pakistan. Under this trade deal, Islamabad gets an estimated annual additional $1.5 billion trade benefits, which are far less than the economic losses Pakistan suffers almost every year because of mass unrest linked with Islamophobia in France. The frequent incidents of blasphemy in France has led to mass unrest across Pakistan.
The European Union is putting pressure on Pakistan, and they want them to weigh and to see whether this decision of expelling the French ambassador from Pakistan, will the government of Pakistan, will the people of Pakistan pay the price? Are they ready?
European Union's concerns go much beyond possibly expelling French ambassador.
Prime Minister Khan has crossed the Rubicon. EU policy towards countries that enable Islamic extremism must be resolute. Withdraw Pakistan's GSP Plus status now.
In an official reaction, Islamabad expressed disappointment with the European Union, pointing out that it reflects a lack of understanding in the context of blasphemy and associated religious sensitivities in Pakistan and elsewhere in the Muslim world.
None of the convict of the blasphemy law was ever executed in Pakistan after successful governments and superior judiciary allegedly buckled under pressure to set convicts free and led them to migrate and settle in Europe. This has led to lynching of 75 under trial prisoners and suspects amid reports of misuse of blasphemy law in isolated cases since 1987 onwards. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Every year on the 1st of May, protesters fill the streets of cities around the world, marching on what's known as May Day or International Labour Day. Demonstrators usually consist of various groups supporting a wide variety of causes. Yet this year in the UK, activists joined more than 40 protests throughout the country centred around one thing: opposition to the controversial Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, with the main focus of dissent coming from London.
Most notable to me
with the fact that the police, under the powers of this legislation, and this is new, will be able to say that this demonstration, for example, through the noise that it's causing, is causing a nuisance. And if that nuisance is serious, they will be able to arrest people, fine them up to £10,000, and imprison them.
What will be next? That bill comes through, that's just going to be one of a whole range of new policies and things that would just silence any form of criticism.
The new legislation pending in Parliament could allow police to impose conditions on protests, including start and finish times and the imposition of noise limits. This bill would also allow the police to prematurely end a protest if it caused serious annoyance to the surrounding community, organisation and businesses, which demonstrators argue is the whole point of protests.
This bill makes it impossible to have any kind of strike, any kind of picket that has any effect.
Thousands upon thousands have turned up here to defend the right to protest, something Brits up and down the country feel is under threat.
More than 600 civil society and protest groups have called for the government to drop the legislation, and the mobilisation of protesters on the streets has already forced a planned passage through Parliament to be delayed. Yet only time will tell whether the huge protests up and down the country has successfully defeated the anti-protest bill. Ahmed Gabello, London.
Over 300 marches took place and hundreds of thousands demonstrated all over France for May Day to claim more rights for the workers. The COVID crisis is hitting the French economy very hard, but not everybody is equally affected by the crisis. The 40 biggest French companies are doing very well despite the COVID crisis, but they prefer to pay benefits for their shareholders rather than improving working conditions. So the main concern for French trade unions now is to save jobs and to stop companies from firing workers.
The big companies have received a lot of public money without any social ecological conditions to fulfill. Public money cannot be given to companies that fire workers continue to pollute, companies that relocate. So we demand that strict conditions be imposed before giving public aid to companies.
The COVID crisis has highlighted the importance of ordinary workers for the French economy. Garbage collectors, railway workers, supermarket cashiers, mostly women, home care workers, delivery drivers, and, of course, hospital workers. Their work is now widely considered as essential to keep the economy running. French President Macron promised to re-evaluate their jobs.
Macron just promised a bonus that is not even obligatory. He does not want to increase the minimum wage, and that is for us to reference. The government thinks that the higher salaries will lead to less jobs, but for us it's the opposite. Higher salaries will boost the economy and create more jobs.
The demonstration in Paris was closely monitored by the police. Clashes broke out when more radical demonstrators threw stones and bottles to the police officers who charged and fired tear gas. There is a lot of frustration among working people. Many blame the French authorities for its disengagement from the public sector, especially the hospital sector, which is crucial to get the coronavirus under control.
The anger is still growing among working people. Those at the front line against the coronavirus demand a permanent upgrade of their jobs, salary and working conditions. But the French government, till now, has only paid them bonuses once. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Across the world, and even in the United States, people took to the streets to celebrate International Workers' Day, May 1st. The turbulent 2020 saw America reverse 50 years of political apathy. Marchers say the time for the lower and middle classes to unite is now, because the 1% is already united and profiting from soaring post-lockdown inequalities every day.
I do think that there will be a rise of leftism because, you know, when we're able to win certain gains through struggles like Black Lives Matter has, you know, getting Chauvin convicted, that shows the power of the working class to fight for more. And, this is just the beginning of the mobilizations I think we're going to see.
Given the status of Chicago as the ideological center of neoliberal thought, many may be surprised that the epicenter of the very first May Day ever was Chicago. In 1886, 100,000 Chicagoan leftists peacefully took to the streets to demand an 8-hour working day and were met with deadly police violence. The U.S. government failed to replace May Day with an attempt at